Now, I'm going to speak this afternoon for a little while on changes in society, and in particular, in the family situation. Whatever changes have taken place, the family group must still be considered the basic unit of all society. It's the bricks, if you like, the brick from which all the building is made. The family group consists of a man and a woman married to each other, plus their offspring. Occasionally some other person is added to the group, but the basic unit remains the same, and it's called the nuclear family. As far as our own society is concerned, this group is based on Christian marriage. Though in areas which have not been touched by the gospel, the same type of group is still present, though often with local variation, again, as we spoke this morning. It is perhaps of no small significance that anti-Christian idealists have singled out this type of social grouping for special criticism, allying it with capitalism. For example, if you look up a copy of the Manifesto of the Communist Party by Marx and Engels, you will find a statement like this. In its completely developed form, this family exists only among the bourgeoisie. But this state of things finds its complement in the practical absence of the family among the proletarians and in public prostitution. Over the years, two basic functions of the nuclear family group have remained unchanged. And these are known as the principles of legitimacy and of reciprocity. The first embodies the work of the family group in providing the means of legitimately placing new human beings within society. The children are given a special social identity, primarily by the father of the group, whether or not, by the way, he's the actual procreator or just a social father, as in the case of an adopted child. The concept that every child shall have a father and only one father is supported by the observations of clinical psychiatry. The other principle, that of reciprocity, is based on what is known in psychological circles as the incest taboo. Practically, it states that sexual partners are not acceptable from within the same family groups, though minor variations of this taboo exist in some communities. That's the reason why, of course, that within the marriage celebrants manual, you'll find all the restrictions regarding consanguinity and restrictions on those who are married from within family groups. So you see that there's an actual interchange, not just of two people, and I limited suggest there's more, but between the whole of these two family groups. Two families come together, really, and this is one of the basic concepts in marriage. Now, the complex structures of rules and standards surrounding these principles have been fairly clearly enunciated over the years, based on Christian ordinance and clearly following the textbook of Holy Scripture, particularly in the writings of Paul. The type of society which resulted from these two concepts was essentially stable. Though there were points of practical weakness, and in retrospect it would appear that there was a not inconsiderable degree of success achieved by the family groups as far as placing socially identifiable new human beings into circulation was concerned. This is where we found our place, of course, in society. We were placed there because we were members of certain families, and we were legitimately placed there. However, at the present time, there are ominous flaws in the erstwhile stability of our society, and some observers trace the roots of such cracks in our social armor to the very structure and function of family groups themselves. The winds of change are blowing hard and with increasing vigor upon society, and nowhere are the resultant changes more marked than in the family. One can look upon these changes from several points of view. One is that a change, such as a movement away from the orthodox family structure, in which the father is the dominant figure and the other members of the family present as a little group around him, towards a much less cohesive family group, in which each member functions more or less as an independent being, is a form of social evolution and represents progressive betterment for the individuals concerned and for society itself. I may just explain this just a little bit, if I may, on the board. Because there are two words which will come across sometimes in writing of this nature. The family, as it used to be, and still is in many societies, consists of a father, there, and a mother, who are bound together in a marriage partnership, and they're like a son. And around this nucleus, they're circled, child number one, child number two, child number three, etc., in the various orders. Such and such. The whole thing, a cohesive unit, held together by love and by other kinds of forces. That is known as familism. And the whole thing is tied together tightly. Now today we find something has happened. First of all, we find that father and mother may or may not be married to each other. Furthermore, there are no longer the close connections between father and mother. They actually go a little bit against each other. As regards the outside world, at one time, only the father was the one who had any social intercourse with the outside world. He was the breadwinner. But in the case of the family of today, the father does one thing in the outside world, and perhaps the mother goes her own way and also becomes a breadwinner. And the children, one, two, three, instead of just keeping circling around the mother and father, they tend to shoot off in different directions. And they each do their own thing in modern terminology. And this is known as atomism. And the progression from familism to atomism is the major change in society that affects marriage today. Now, as I say, some people might look at some of the humanists, for example, say, aha, this is advancement, this is evolution in practice. Or again, there's a view that over a period of years and centuries, there are cycles of change. At one time, there appears to be familism, and at the next time in history, a tendency to atomism, and that the thing will go backwards and forwards as long as time exists. But of course, you and I as believers have a different thought about this. Because I personally believe that these changes which are now taking place are the evidences of the last day, of the perilous times. And nowhere in scripture can we find, or nowhere in literature for that matter, can we find a more up-to-date description of present-day society than we can in the pages of the New Testament. Tremendous changes have taken place. The swing away from Christian belief and practice, of course, is a major factor in this change. The role of the mother has often changed from that of a housewife to an income earner. And it's been difficult, increasingly difficult, for children to recognize just what part a father plays. At one time, for example, in the Jewish family, the father was looked upon as the supreme authority. He was the court of final appeal. But in today's families, who is the final authority? Sometimes it appears to be the mother. Sometimes it appears to be the oldest child in a multi-child family. And of course, to make it even worse, as I've suggested, there are greatly increased knowledge imparted in ordinary schools to young adolescents. They mature earlier sexually, as I suggested. And of course, their increasing desire to establish their own independence at a younger and younger age, and this tendency, of course, is often legally backed, allowing them more freedom of expression. Parents today, of course, are also freer from inhibitions. For example, in discussing some of their most intimate and personal relationships in front of their own children, thinking that this will help their children to be freer in their own lives. And this has more than done away with the secrecy which once existed, although that itself at one stage was potentially traumatic to young people. So young people are more and more aware of problems between mothers and fathers. And of course they will actually carry this with them into the marriage situation. The bride knows of the problems within her own parents' marriage. She will go away with a certain concept of marriage and the roles of mother and father in the family, husband and wife. And so will the bridegroom. He'll have a different concept. And they carry these things into their own marriage. Oftentimes realizing, perhaps during the period of engagement, that there are differences in their own backgrounds and differences of thought. And these are the things which, in answering Mr. Hines' question earlier, I suggest it must be actually spoken about, because they have caused tremendous damage in marriages in the past. You know, the longer I live and the longer I work in this field, the more thankful I am to be a Christian. I cannot understand how some marriages exist at all with people who are not Christians. And yet I think that so very often in our own marriages there could be increased happiness if only we were a little bit more open in discussing things. Now, the majority of families who have these changes within them perhaps don't exhibit it to a marked degree, but it does affect all people to some extent. Within the family groups described, the parental acknowledgement of responsibility in rearing and training children has been assumed. But you as celebrants and as counselors know that in reality, our social history is packed with cases of parent neglect of children and young people, ranging from a relatively minor degree in which the parents are so occupied with their own interests and pursuits, including business and including church activities, that they tend to forget the need that children have of them, to cases of major degree, which unfortunately have gone as far as child battering and child murder. It appears strange to realize that amongst the many peoples of the world, those of Anglo-Saxon descent have become universally and traditionally recognized as being the most neglectful of the children. And that trait, by the way, goes back for centuries. It was King Kama who once said, "You English take great care of your goods, but you throw away your children." And the Jewish Book of Wisdom, the Talmud, states, "By the breath of the children, the world is preserved." And it is to the credit of the Jewish race that they had never neglected a child. Josephus, one of the greatest historians, once wrote, "Our principal care is to educate our children." But having presented these two opposite pictures, it is now unfortunately necessary for me to point out that over the last two or three decades, our traditional neglect appears to have increased. And even the Jewish outlook has become modified, judging from the reports coming through from the kibbutz of modern Israel. Our speed of living, our civilization's accent and materialism, and the various factors already mentioned which lie behind the progressive extinction of the traditional nuclear family group, all have added to this picture. And the whole situation has been further aggravated by the increasing number of broken marriages and divorces and separations and even just extramarital relationships. Now, I've deliberately gone into the matter of the change within the family groups in a little bit of detail, and only shortage of time prevents me giving a more thorough examination. I've done it because I'm convinced that this is perhaps the most important area when it comes to actual counseling, and we've got to be aware of the kind of changes that could be occurring within the family groups from which the potential bride and bridegroom emanate. But let's have a look at some of the other changes which are just as important. First of all, there's a change in man's attitude to authority and to discipline. And I suppose that this can be related to the great advances in general knowledge and in the sphere of science. Over recent years, man has increased his ability to manipulate the environment to his own benefit. And although he's perhaps still somewhat afraid of his own new knowledge and its possible ill effects, he has now so much power at his fingertips that he tends to consider himself to be self-sufficient and master of his own destiny. Thus, to subscribe to the idea of being under authority, any form of authority, or under the control of anyone, or any system of thought, is to succinctly admit inferiority. From having the idea that someone having more of the benefits of this civilization is but a short step, and on either side occurring within a community where expression of formerly hidden resentment is condoned, leads to what is known as protest. Not that this type of reaction is new, but it certainly is now recognized as a normal part of modern society. Can you stand me quoting Aristotle again? This time from his writings entitled Politics. Listen to what he says. The universal and chief cause of revolutionary feeling is the desire of equality. When men think they are equal to others who have more than themselves. Or again, the desire of inequality and superiority, when conceiving themselves to be superior, they think that they have not more, but the same or less than their inferiors. It's this very reaction that's now causing so much disquiet amongst many homes, as the adolescents in the family groups represented show this revolutionary feeling to the traditional heads of these groups, the parents, and it's a short step from that attitude to rebellion against employers, teachers, lecturers, authoritarian figures in general, governments, religious authorities, and God himself. And, of course, this is also part of the problem with the so-called women's liberation movement, where there is a move of rebellion from the woman against the man. A movement, by the way, that I'm quite sure that Isabel Pankhurst never realized the full consequences of when she chained herself to the railing so long ago. And a further great change within society is its concept of right or wrong, its moral sense. This, of course, is closely related to the respect paid to the idea of God and the church and so on. It's a form of rebellion against a restricting authority, though this time it is one that is within the very natural makeup of man as sinner. Whilst frequently it involves going against a written law, it is often a deliberate going against an innate inner feeling, with a frequent rationalization that if something brings pleasure, then there can be no wrongness in it whatsoever. And this hedonistic and pleasure-seeking approach has quickly come into the field of sex, though society still has a rather double feeling about this particular subject. Sex is joyfully presented, either directly or indirectly, in almost every advertising project. Whether it's going to be for talcum powder, cigarettes, alcohol, hair cream, toothpaste. I don't know whether it ever got as far as advertising certain specific brands of penicillin, Graham, but I wouldn't have been surprised even there.
Holidays?
Oh, that's right. All these things. The point is that sex advertising has become tremendously important. But if that advertising is followed, and the inherent suggestions in that advertising are followed through, then that same society is ever so quick to condemn the possible consequences of that behavior. And freedom of sexual expression is openly advocated by a certain section of society, but it's that same section who condemns the girl who quickly falls pregnant outside marriage. It will become quickly evident on consideration that whilst in previous generations, when the nuclear family was a closely knit unit, the parents could deliberately shield their young people from what they considered unacceptable sectors of society, nowadays the mass media bring the views of all sections of society worldwide into the very homes concerned. Thus, as the atomism within the family groups grow, young people are becoming more and more vulnerable to a multitude of conflicting ideologies and social patterns of behavior. Again, the reaction may be to escape from the parental home in order to experiment, sometimes to escape into marriage, thinking that that could be the answer. It is often with this situation that students in universities and colleges strike so many, many problems. Professor William Barclay, whose books I'm sure you've read, or some of them anyway, wasn't very far from the mark when he wrote in one of the Scotland's newspapers a few years ago, and I quote, "The more power men possess, they need a power to control them. The more liberty into which any generation enters, the more self-discipline it must have. There is in this world a vast place for a church which will no longer have no policy but to compromise, but which will uphold an uncompromising chastity. There are signs that men realize this." End of the quote. And certainly there is presently a need for something to happen. But as Dr. Peter Worsley points out in his book on sociology, no society practicing complete promiscuity has lasted long. And this, from even the humanistic point of view, is certainly the end result if present trends go on unchecked. Therefore it means that as far as we are concerned, as Christians, we ought to be much more uncompromising than we tend to be. Oh, I know that we say we stick to Scripture, but do we really? At the moment that traditionalism comes in, we are beginning to veer away from what the Scripture says. And you know, I'm afraid that there is a tendency, either through popularity seeking, or perhaps through even fear of what men may say, to compromise, even sometimes within the most fundamental of believers and of Christians generally. Now, I want to mention here, I've got so many lectures here on these subjects, but I want to take just one or two little bits out of this. But I want to mention at this stage one particular thing, and that is the question of abortion. Now, my first degree in medicine was obtained in Aberdeen. And the man who gave me my final examination in gynecology and obstetrics, the man by name of Professor Serdugo Baird. Obviously, I got to know him well because he was one of my teachers in that subject. But when David Steele, who was a government member for Peebleshire in the British Parliament, brought forward his private member's bill for the extension of the grounds for ending pregnancy, Dugald Baird was the man who immediately gave him his full support. And I think myself that there was almost a shade of evil in the whole thing. Because Dugald Baird collected around him 12 eminent obstetricians and gynecologists throughout Britain. And eventually they became known as Dugald Baird and the 12. And it was mostly as a result of their pushing this particular subject that eventually it went through in Parliament. When I was back in Aberdeen a few years ago, before I went back for the last time in 1966, the bill was going through. And it was surprising that in Aberdeen, where I worked for a short time, there were a tremendous number of people coming for termination of pregnancy. Some of you may know that it was the communist countries, and in particular, strange to say, the small country of Bulgaria, which first chopped its abortion laws and began to cut down on the freedom of having abortions. They said that the person applying for an abortion had to have had at least 5 children, and termination of pregnancy would only be given after the person had appeared before a council and had given adequate reason to the council that her pregnancy ought to be terminated. Now, in Australia today, we have a great deal of pressure on the subject of legalizing abortion much more than it is. And I think that as Christian counselors, we've got to be very, very frank about this. I believe that abortion is a distortion of what God teaches. I really believe this, and as I say, the longer I've lived, the more I come to it. Because during a public debate preceding the bill to reform abortion in May 1973 in Australia, that one woman advocating more liberal legislation concluded her letter to the press in this way. I quote, "I have answered simply because it is a simple fact and have left religion alone where it ought to stay." In other words, recognizing the fact that religion was against abortion. So the morality of the act is something which is recognized by non-Christians as well as Christians. That comment is typical of almost the whole of the discussion from the pro-abortionist point of view. The question of whether the fetus is to be reckoned as human life and therefore to be protected as such is not dismissed by argument. It is not debated. It is simply ignored. There seems, in fact, to be considerable irritation that it should have been raised at all by anyone. There's good reason for this. It is only possible to contemplate easy abortion if you can think of the fetus as a scrap of tissue, an it, some tiny thing hidden away, unseen and impersonal, some lower form of life, and that is all. And that is why these pictures of aborted fetuses put out by the Right to Life Association on their brochure were found to be so offensive, and the Council of Australian Humanist Societies could vilify that publicity as a wild, emotional and sectarian campaign. Is this human life? If you can only be pro-abortionist while you close your mind to this issue, while you speak in language that you're virtually disinfected about termination of pregnancy, and shut your eyes to what abortion really is, you're not facing facts. The Bible doesn't have a great deal to say on the subject. but it maintains the perspective that God's interest in man does not begin at birth. But even in the womb, God's creative concern is seen. Psalm 139, verses 13 to 16. For thou didst form my inward parts. Thou didst knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise thee, for thou art fearful and wonderful. Wonderful are thy works. Thou knowest me right well. My frame was not hid from thee when I was being made in secret, intricately wrought in the depths of the earth. Thy eyes beheld my unformed substance. In thy book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. I need say no more. God's word is a final authority. That's abortion. And it's something that you may well come up with. I think perhaps there are some physical things that may well be indications for termination, but they are very, very few and far between. And I may say that even working in Aberdeen, in university, a few years ago as a senior lecturer and as a consultant, not once in 3.5 years did I ever at any stage feel that any patient referred to me for a question of abortion was justified in having it. And I think that that, again, may speak for itself. Divorce. As we read this morning, or we heard this morning, Augustine, Luther, Thomas Aquinas, Calvin, all recognized that separation was possible. None of them agreed that remarriage was possible as long as either partner was alive. Later, the agreement was that divorce was to be granted only on the ground that the Lord himself indicated of adultery. And even then, with strict conditions. In this country today, we have, of course, a great deal of confusion over the new act. That's the new now. And as you'll hear in a minute, there's another act coming out now. Until 1961, the legislation regarding divorce, and for that matter the custody of children, came under the realm of individual state acts. But from 1961, when the present Family Law Act came into being, from that point on, it has become a Commonwealth thing. Mr. Enderby described the Act as being the most enlightened and humane social reform to be introduced in Australia since the Second World War. And if you want to get some idea of the actual thought behind the Act, read section 43 of the Act itself, which is in four sections, and it simply states this. A. Courts which are dealing with problems concerning family law have to consider A. the need to preserve and protect the institution of marriage as the union of a man and a woman to the exclusion of all others voluntarily entered into for life. B. the need to give the widest possible protection and assistance to the family as the natural and fundamental group unit of society, particularly while it is responsible for the care and education of dependent children. C. the need to protect the rights of children and to promote their welfare. And D. the means available for assisting parties to a marriage to consider reconciliation or the improvement of their relationship to each other and to the children of the marriage. Great ideals. No question of that. In 1959, the Matrimonial Bill, the Matrimonial Act, was introduced, which brought with it the concept that if two people were separated for a period of 5 years, then divorce could be granted. Now that was one of 14 grounds for divorce in the original Act. And these particular things were, I'll just read one or two of them to you. Adultery, the refusal to consummate a marriage, rape, sodomy, or bestiality, frequent convictions, criminal convictions, an attempt to murder, non-compliance with a restitution order, desertion for 2 years, cruelty, habitual drunkenness, imprisonment, failure to pay maintenance, insanity, and presumption of death. These are rather complicated issues. And of course, particularly in the case of a divorce that was going through on the basis of cruelty, that had to be proved. And very often the children had to be taken into court to give evidence. I suppose that this was probably the most traumatic situation of all. And I have had several children referred to me professionally whose emotional injuries stemmed from having to, well, to turn traitor against the parent. Because that's what it amounts to, breaking up this nuclear family. When this new act came in, there was an advantage. Because the 14 grounds for divorce were swept to one side, and only one was left. And the single ground, as it now stands, is irretrievable marriage breakdown. The evidence of that being separation for a period of 12 months. No charges are put against, or no blame is put. It's a non-blame act. The husband's not to blame because of his drinking. The wife's not to blame because of her adultery. The only situation is they are living apart for a period of 12 months. Certainly, there is every attempt made to try and get them together again. But nevertheless, this is the important thing. If the court is directed under the Act that if they have the slightest likelihood that the marriage relationship will be resumed, then they are not to grant divorce. So there are very, very real, and I think a sincere attempt to stop the sudden surge of divorce actions. Children don't come into it except when custody comes into it. And one of the interesting things about the Act, which I haven't got time to go into, is that the children who could be covered by custody involve a tremendous group, actually, when it comes to, it's not just natural children, who's adopted children, and so on. But when custody comes into it, the children again come into court. Now, at present time, and I'm very glad that Alvin is here, because he brought along today the weekly Hansard of the House of Representatives for the session in Parliament on the first 4 days of June this year. There is at present, before the House of Representatives, a bill for an act to amend the Marriage Act. And there are one or two things that are rather interesting in it. Perhaps the most important thing is its provision for counselling pre-marriage wise. I'm going to talk on pre-marriage counselling in the next and the last talk. But in this act, and I've read from the Hansard now, from Mr. Ellicott, the Attorney General. Quote, "This bill seeks to uphold the institution of marriage by encouraging a greater awareness in persons of the nature, dimensions, and responsibilities of marriage before they take the decisive step to enter into marriage. In other words, while the Family Law Act deals with cures, this bill deals with prevention." He goes on, "I would regard as the most far-reaching the provisions in the bill for the subsidizing by the government of premarital educational programs." The bill will give, in other words, money to various organizations to go ahead with counseling for people approaching marriage. This also is important, and this affects every celebrant. The government has decided that an additional useful way of drawing the attention of engaged couples to the availability of these programs of education would be by requiring marriage celebrants to give couples information about the courses on receiving notice from them of the intended marriage. And I may say that the notice of intended marriage under this bill is to be increased from 7 days to 1 month. The bill therefore inserts a requirement in the Marriage Act for a celebrant to hand to the parties to an intended marriage a document in a form to be prescribed outlining the obligations and consequences of marriage and indicating the availability of both premarital education and pre-marriage counseling. And there's one more little bit here. The bill does not go to the extent of imposing a more general requirement of compulsory attendance at premarital education of counseling. I understand that it is the view of most marriage counseling experts that counseling or education is most likely to be effective where it is sought voluntarily. In other words, when the person comes up to us and says, look, will you marry me? And they are almost asking to be cancelled. So I think perhaps that's, perhaps we've gone through. Oh, there's one other thing. The virtually obsolete action for breach of promise of marriage is abolished. That's the bill now before Parliament. That's right, Alwyn. So that perhaps covers the divorce laws to some extent and the changing social patterns. I hope that you've realized that my knowledge is not complete on these subjects. But at least there's a little bit there that you can think about.